Welcome to the Leadership Labs with DeepRec.ai, the podcast where we delve into the fascinating world of deep tech entrepreneurship, company founders, and venture capitalists. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey. In each episode, we explore the minds behind groundbreaking technologies, the visionaries who dare to push the boundaries of innovation, and the investors who fuel the growth of tomorrow's game changers.
Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Morning, Anthony. Not too bad now. First cup of tea of the day. What about yourself?
Yeah, good. Coffee in front of me. My first Irish guest on the podcast now. So happy to get it going. Our guest today is Fiona Della Hunty. Fiona is a co-founder at Lua Health. Look, before you tell us a little bit about Lua, Fiona, why don't you start off and give us a little bit of background about you and I guess what took you down the road of becoming a co-founder?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. I'm a Galway man myself. I would have a degree in psychology, which would have stemmed from a deep interest in human behaviour generally, like what makes us tick? Why do we do this and why do we do that? Finished up with that degree and became super fascinated then. That was 2016, by this kind of growing field of AI, of modeling behavior, kind of with mathematical representations. That was just the first time we were seeing kind of reinforcement learning, which is a big part of ChatGPT, ironically, come out. So that spurred me on to do a 2-year degree over in Sweden in machine learning and in AI. Which was a bit of a challenge to take a postgraduate course in somewhere I had no undergraduate experience, but got through it nonetheless. Then ended up moving to where I am today in Berlin, working for some startups in both a digital health, then some kind of more traditional AI startups. And now for about a bit more than a year and a half, been leading Lua. Which is an Irish-based startup.
Look, I know Gina quite well. I guess in terms of, if we say scale up, high growth, like these guys would definitely hit that. You know, hitting good series funding time and time again, always increasing growth, opening new offices. Has seen that sort of made you strive to want to be in that position with your own business, or?
It was yes and no. So the company I worked at before Gina, a company called Moonpad, and they were the other end of the spectrum. So they were I joined just as they were being acquired by a company. So that was like late stage. And then I jumped into Gina, and I was the second employee on the product side. And then, as you said, like new employees joining every week, new offices opening, complete, I don't want to use the word chaos, but exciting times, like everything changing all the time. So I think when I took that Lua, I was like, there's bits of each of these things I want to take. There was bits of that velocity at Gina that A, probably didn't suit me, and B, I didn't think suited any team, and vice versa. There was bits of that late stage startup, and I was like, if I was doing that all over again, I'd want to get them in early because they were kind of mistakes down the road. So yeah. I think it was nice to see two sides of the coin and use that experience.
So then, yeah, look, give us a little overview about Lua. Spare no details, you know, where did it all start? What was the initial idea, right? So you've gone from being in Berlin, tech PM, to co-founder of Galway.
Yeah. Lua originally started many years ago when I was just towards the end of my master's. I ended up back in Galway in the National AI Centre, which is called the Insight Centre for Data Science. They're based across the entire island of Ireland. Each university kind of has a cluster of them, but I was based in the Galway one. And while I was there, I was working on some technology that looked at the intersection of psychology and computer science, NLP. So there was some quite old research, like 30 years back in psychology, that said there are these things called linguistic markers. So the way in which we talk convey things about our mental health, our mental state. And that was like super interesting at the time, but had no practical application because no one was going to like read through pages of your writing and like count out certain words and certain phrases and this sort of stuff. Now, obviously, when computers came along, we could do that programmatically. So there was kind of a new birth of life into this field. And I came in just around when that was happening. And the first thing I noticed was this is a load of computer scientists doing very computer science-y things to a clinical space. So what I mean by that is they were doing things like detecting depression as a binary outcome. And like, excuse my language, but that's kind of BS. Like no clinician would ever use depression on a binary outcome. We have like standardized clinical scales for that sort of stuff. So like, why not use them? So myself and one who's now my co-founder, Dr. Arkan, we spent a lot of time and we published a couple of papers building algorithms in this field that were very clinically informed and very clinically appropriate. Then I went back into industry for a couple of years, and during that time, we got support from Enterprise Ireland, which is the national, I don't even know what they're called, despite having talked to them about once a week for the last 3 years, national kind of semi-state government body for startups and scale-ups in Ireland. So they gave us quite a significant amount of funding, a little bit more than $500,000, to take this tech into kind of quote-unquote spin it out of the university. So that's the process of seeing is it commercially feasible, and if so, to build a team around it and to bring it out into a startup. And that formally kicked off then September last year, and that is what is now Lua. And I suppose the current iteration of Lua now, because there's been some kind of minor pivots and spins on it, we primarily work in the corporate well-being space, but we also do some of the medical space, and our whole focus is on early detection and identification of poor mental well-being or mental disorders. So like some of your listeners might be familiar with things like Headspace, Calm, mindfulness apps, all this sort of stuff. That's not our ballpark. That's treatment. Our ballpark is like one stage earlier saying, you know, you, Anthony, you need something now. And when it comes to like mental health broadly, I always use the analogy of a broken leg. Like if you break your leg, you're straight into A&E. And there's no debate about that. You can see your leg is like snapped in pain. When it comes to mental health, it festers for a long time. Like typically the research says someone who's depressed, it's an 8 years till they get treated. Like that's 8 years of suffering where they're, and I've been in that state myself. Like it sounds stupid as a psychologist, but you're kind of like, it's not that bad. It'll be better tomorrow. Like it's just kind of a couple of days are down. And it's not until like someone, you know, my girlfriend or someone turns around and goes, no, it's been like that for a month now. I'm like, has it? Like, has it really been like that? And I think that's what's quite insidious about poor mental health is that we discount it, and then it just festers for a long time. So what we're trying to do is help people know they need help and what help they need.
Yeah. I guess an issue with it is as well is you become disengaged in the most important things. You become disengaged in work. Then you're, add insult to injury, you're now under more pressure at work. You're exactly. Disengaged with your partner.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, if you're rowing then, again, it's all, it compounds really quickly.
Exactly, yeah. No, that's a really good point. It's really insidious in that way as well, that it's like the one thing that makes you not want to leave the house and go get help or not want to talk about it. It's really insidious like that.
So if we talk about it in terms of, let's say, having the capabilities or the, not necessarily even capabilities, but if you think about it, the understanding of delivering. So as you mentioned as well, you know, very much research heavy background, two industry roles. Do you feel those two industry roles helped you define a bit more of what Lua has to deliver to actually be a product? Or do you feel that if you had have done it, or you would have been able to take it to market anyway, having stayed in research? What's your thoughts on your experience?
They were absolutely vital. taking research out into the commercial, into the commercial world is tough. And I think a lot of technology fails at that point, because researchers, and speaking as a researcher originally, you're trained to research, you're not trained to commercialize. Those are two very different skills. And it was the fact that I did work in industry and I saw what a product in industry looks like. I suppose typically speaking, researchers strive for excellence. Like, you'll always tell yourself, it's not good enough. It's not good enough to put out. We have to, get 2% more accuracy, or we have to solve this bug.
If I can get more data,
like, it's just not good enough. But then when you're working in industry, you're seeing, well, it probably is. Like, for what we're doing, it probably is good enough, or at least you have to start somewhere. So learning that meant, I'd say it was absolutely vital to have a bit of experience in the real world.
Good. So, yeah, let's talk about that then. So, spinning out of university, again, something that is very common, and I would say, unfortunately, lesser common in Ireland. I know, look, you've got the ADAP program in Trinity, which is obviously quite popular, and the DCU Innovation Campus. But even in terms of reality and scale, and I wasn't even sure of the spin-out program in Galway. That's how much I don't know about them. But if you probably look at TUM would have more university spin-outs than the whole of Ireland year on year, I would say. So what was your experience with spinning out from university in Ireland? What's that been like?
Well, as with everything, I suppose there's good points and bad points. Depending on the sector, I think there's spin-outs vary. So, like, anything in medtech or biotech or pharmacy is nearly always a spin-out. I don't have the statistics, but I'd say, like, upwards of 50% of all medtech companies have come from a university, because they kind of have to. Like, where else are they going to build up that research base? Interestingly, and I couldn't find the statistic before we jumped on the call, but when it comes to AI, I think it's somewhere around 40 to 15% of all AI companies have spun out of a university lab. And then when it comes to, like, typical SaaS companies, it's less than 1%. which, again, like, if you're building a calendar app, like, why would you have decades of research behind you? That makes no sense.
That's true. There's also elements of most AI companies are very expensive to even get an MVP off the ground,
Exactly.
Makes a difference in that.
And typically also, I think, like, AI companies, when you are in front of investors, they expect a certain level of, I suppose, experience on the AI side. And having come from a university, having publications that sort of ticks that box, it would be hard to justify that otherwise, I would say, not having done it myself. I think the Irish startup ecosystem is actually quite strong, to your point. I think the Irish one, maybe not as strong as the UK one, but is quite strong. Probably stronger than most other European countries, actually. I don't think the ecosystem here in Germany is that strong. Israel is quite strong, and the US is quite strong. So in Ireland, I think we're pretty well placed. Not perfect, but we're pretty well placed. I suppose on the good side is I suppose the funding and the ecosystem you operate in. So you can get reasonably large amounts of funding, non-dilutive, to keep you alive, and you can operate inside of the university at an early stage that kind of reduces your overheads, means you don't have to, like, set up payrolls. You put people on the university payroll. You don't have to learn about, like, HR and tax and all those things. And if you are a kind of a med tech company, you can use lab space, you can use kind of research labs and chemicals and all those sorts of things. That's, like, not so applicable for AI companies. Although in saying that, there is, like, high performance computing and things that the university has that we can tap into. So there's kind of positives on that side. Vice versa, those can become negatives quite quickly. So like, you're working within the university bureaucracy, so things don't always move fast, and the university is designed to to run as a university, not as a startup. So, like I suppose to give one example, it took us, we wanted to hire a software engineer, and from the moment we were like, okay, we want to work with you, the university's HR team took like 4 months to generate those contracts, which for like having worked in the industry, that should be like a 2-week process.
It should be a 2-day process with all the technology we've available.
Yeah. So like I suppose was I good that I don't have to learn how to do all that, but bad that it, you know, it slows you down to a 4-month degree. So kind of apples and oranges, goods and bads. But there's a lot of, I think the precedence and the ecosystem is quite important. So like some of your listeners in the mental health space, there was a company called Silver Cloud. Some of your listeners may or may not be familiar with. They spun out of Trinity College about 7 years ago. And they were just last year acquired by Amwell in the US for, I think, $500 million in the mental health space. So good precedence there to show how a company kind of goes out of the university, jumps to America, expands, and then like ends up with an exit. So that precedent is quite important because it means people are familiar with how you should operate and like what path you should follow. So I'd say that's quite good as well.
Now, I'm going to sort of just go back a little bit. You said it was really helpful in the university because you didn't have to learn HR, contracts, legal. I guess, what about Lua Health's branding, go-to-market, logo? Like, where did that all come from?
Yeah, so I suppose we're now in the process of spinning out where we need all those things. So yeah, like it's kind of putting them a lot on the long finger. Like you do eventually need to learn all the HR and all the legal stuff. We also initially would have operated onto the university's branding as a research team and then pivoted to our own branding and our own entity as we spin out. Lua is Gaelic, is Irish for Galua, which is earlier. So that's like we detect things earlier. I never fail to throw that in because I'm proud of having come up with it, but I don't get to say it enough.
I'm with you on that. I'm restricted on children's names and everything that I'd like at the moment as well.
Oh Jesus, we have the best names, at least in my opinion. But yeah, I empathise that others may not agree with that statement.
Yeah, my girlfriend was very specific in saying I couldn't have one that people would not be able to spell. I was like, or say, I'm like, yeah, you can. I was, but we know them. That's the difference.
Yeah.
So you mentioned as well, and you touched on it about setting up Lua, and you spoke to me on it about you want to run it as a product company, and this again all comes from your industry experience that you've picked up. I'm curious, like, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think to me, a product company is maybe the opposite. I suppose to put it another way, I see a lot of startups being founded by engineers and writing beautiful code bases. Like having an idea, building a whole product, and then going to the market and going like, you know, why would you use it? Like, we have this great product, why would you use it? Or believing that people, you need a fully functioning end-to-end product before you can kind of validate that people will use it. I think a product company does the opposite. So the first thing we did was we went out to the market. We had like hundreds, that's not an exaggeration, of conversations, just asking people very broadly about their problems when it came to mental health. So like how those conversations would typically go is we would find people like senior HR leaders, senior like CEOs, and also like mental health professionals like psychiatrists and consultants. And we would go, I suppose, for your company, what does mental health mean to you? Like, is it something you think about? Is it not? And like a fair percentage were like, no, it's not something on my radar. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Maybe I personally don't think that's fine, but I'm not going to lecture you on why you're wrong. But then some of them were like, no, it is a problem. And specifically, you know, we've been buying all these like headspaces and things, but no one's been using them. And I'm like, okay, there's, you know, that utilization, that's a problem. Like I you've just validated to me that that is a problem. And there's a really good book for anyone listening called The Mom Test that says how you should like handle these conversations so you don't bias them. Like you should absolutely not go into these conversations going, is this a problem for you? Because obviously people will just be nice to you and go, oh, of course, you know, yes it is.
Yeah,
You seem like a nice person.
you're leading the conversation then.
Exactly. So we've got to flipping it around and having them get there on their own. Is a real validation. So we had these conversations, and then a certain number of them converted into like interesting offers. At the end of the conversation, they go like, "Oh, can you solve this for me? Like, let's set up a call. I want you to solve this for me." Which is slightly terrifying because at the time we wouldn't have always had the tech ready, and we were kind of bluffing our way through and say, "Oh yeah, of course we can solve that for you." Just like, let's make sure that calls in a couple of weeks, please. But I think that was good because we built to demand, and we also like some of our very early assumptions were, I suppose like the best example of that is our first integration was Slack. We built it into Slack, and that is because me and my co-founder firmly believed everyone used Slack because we use Slack. Turns out nobody uses Slack in the corporate world. Everyone uses Teams. So, like we did waste like 2 months building into Slack to
I
find out
assume
that every one of our
you're a software
customers.
developer in a corporate team, you use Slack and Teams.
Quite possibly, but for where we're selling to, everyone uses like they only watch it inside of Teams. So that's a good example of where we just made an assumption that we thought was really solid and sound and was completely wrong. And we only got there by having conversations with people. And we luckily we only wasted 2 months. Like we didn't build a fully fledged product, but you know we could have run that risk. And that applies in every aspect of our product. So like any feature we build, I typically will wait to hear the request for that feature from the mouths of a couple of our users before I invest developer time in it. I don't make assumptions that, now, like sometimes I have hypotheses, like I think they'll probably want a dashboard, but I haven't started that code base until a couple of them return to me and go, oh, could we see this on a dashboard? I'm like, yeah, you can, we can do that for you. So I think that's also saved us probably a lot of time and probably stopped us wasting a lot of resources in that we're building everything to demand.
Now, I've got a question about, let's say, the initial market research. How did you define who you wanted to contact to find out the information from them? And then also what you wanted to say to them, right? Because again, you said you're building it to demand, so you didn't really know, but you had an idea of who the man was, you know, the person who has the authority, the person who has is in the decision-making capacity.
That's a good question. I think we took a
That's
pretty
an old sales term, by the way. It's an acronym, MAN.
I suppose like getting into this, I had no sales experience, and at the end of the day, a lot of this is sales, and that's something I have learned. As researchers, we probably took a pretty systematic approach to this. Like we sat down. Actually, before we did that, we went out, and it was quite valuable. We talked to about 30 or so what I call KOIs, so just like people, kind of experts in the field of mental health, and we just like literally had chit chats with them. We were like, where do you see the market going? And a couple of them were like, here, here, and here. And they basically gave us four problems or four verticals that they were like, this is where I put my money. So then we went out and tested each of those. So we sat down and we came up with like more concrete hypotheses of each of those four verticals. We used the Lean Business Canvas. This is quite good for that, just like mapping it out. And then we're like, okay, who do we need to speak to in each of these verticals? And then who, like again, to your point, who's the decision maker in each of these verticals? Because this is again something we've learned that, you know, you're probably could be a burning problem for someone like mid-level at a company. Doesn't mean they're going to buy it. So like you have to hit those that C typically that C-suite when it comes to large multinationals or someone very close to it. So we did it all quite systematically. We put it like it ended up in Excel sheets. It was all like tallied up. But at the end of the day, the most important piece of metric was what they turning around to us at the end of the call and going, can you do this for me? that's like what really drove the conversations. And there is like frameworks and resources out there to help you through all of this. The MOM test, certainly, Lean Business Canvas. But really sitting down, like mapping out those verticals, diving into them and like going out kind of outwards was good. It kept its structure on what we were doing. And we did end up in one of those verticals, which we are now. Like, it didn't work.
So you also mentioned you're sort of building it on demand, which suits you right now. What about when you look into the future? You want to look to scale this out? I mean, look, naturally, we want every business to have mental health support, but you cannot do that on a one-to-one basis for everyone. Are you looking at something that could be an out-of-the-box solution? Maybe you can tailor, add on some features, packages to suit certain businesses, but then it would also allow you to scale as a business, and then it would also allow businesses to scale your product within them.
Yeah, I definitely, there's a couple of things on that. I think, so technically speaking, we, over the next like year or two, or a year probably, we will have to convert our code base from being very customer-centric, like we built it quite specific to a number of customers, to a general out-of-the-box solution. That's quite an interesting technical problem.
Yeah.
And I definitely wouldn't recommend, again, like to your point about product companies, I think early engineers would probably have tried to build it out of the box from the first line of code. And maybe that's good, but maybe they also would have wasted a lot of time. Whereby building it customizable, we got to test a lot of things quite quickly. And yes, it's probably going to be a bit of a pain now to box that up, but I would rather do that than vice versa.
As you in a kind of like golden opportunity here, though, you've got a couple of customers, you can get a lot of real feedback, which if you go straight out of the box, I guess it's kind of like you can't put the genie back in the bottle. They don't know what they didn't have.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it really means that we haven't one feature out there that's not being used. We don't like one line of code that's not being used. So that's very lean, very, very accurate. And again, like as always, you don't know what you don't know. We learned a load of stuff. Like we did not think that these would be problems for us, and they turned out to be. So that now we know to solve them going forward. So yeah, you don't know what you don't know, I think is really important.
Nice. So you also mentioned and touched on it a little bit about sales. And again, it's an area that I'm always fascinated with, particularly with businesses your size, right? There's you, co-founder, an engineer, and a couple of other people in the business, but you don't have a dedicated sales rep right now, am I right?
Not a sales rep, but we do have a third co-founder whose background will be sales. And this is something I found fascinating, that when him and myself were on a call, there was just some way he could talk to them that I couldn't, that converted them. And I listened, I wrote it down. I was like, I do not know what you are doing that I am not doing, but you are doing it so much better. And I still, to this day, do not know what he is doing. But it showed me that sales is a real skill. It's something I'm getting better at. But it is a really skillful skill, and it is absolutely important. It is as important as the quality of your code base, because yeah, like you can have a beautiful code base but no sales, you're not going anywhere, and well, vice versa. If you have great sales but no tech, you're not going anywhere either.
Well, how many companies go on like a massive uplift of a takeoff for having fantastic sales teams, but the product they're selling is absolutely dreadful.
Yeah,
they'll die long term, but I mean their initial success will look great.
No, I'm quite aware of that balance, I suppose, and like sometimes the demand is, you know, oh, can we jump to this company now, and you kind of have to push back and go, no, we don't have the tech resources to deploy with them as well, like push that off for another month or two, because I do think there is reputation damage to scaling the tech too fast. And to like having downtime and all these things, and touch wood, we've had really good success in that. We haven't had downtime. product hasn't broken for any of our customers yet. I'm, as I say this, it's probably crashing and burning. But I think we've balanced things quite well. We've balanced demand versus supply thus far quite well.
Nice. Now I want to sort of take you back here a bit to, let's say, maybe your time when you were doing your initial research at Insight, working at MindDoc or at Gina. If you were to meet yourself now, like, how would you say your brain thinks differently as a co-founder? I mean, number one, you've already mentioned there's a product difference, but like, is there any sort of fundamental shifts in your mindset, in your thought process that jump out to you?
There's probably loads. I think one big shift was around what I would call unit economics. How much does it cost you to build one unit of your product versus how much does it cost you to sell that? And how much are you making? Like, are you fundamentally making a profit? And that's something hanging around these SaaS companies nobody was ever talking about, but is actually the lifeblood of your company. Like, can you legitimately make your product for cheaper than it is, than the customer's willing to pay for it? And any business I would go in forward now, that would be the first question on my lips. And how much is that differentiation? How are you like reducing the cost to build or like upping the cost to sell? Is there enough people out there who want to buy it? All these possibly quite boring economic questions, but I think founders discount them they only take them way too late. But will actually tell you, is this even worth building in? Like, are you building a product that globally only two customers are going to want? Like, that's just a waste of everyone's time, really.
Nice. I mean, are you doing the finance report here, or where have you sort of picked this up?
It
seems like you're prepared for VCs.
I think, yeah, well, I suppose to some degree I am. Like, I am in front of VCs pitching, but I think every founder needs to be aware of this, even if they're, like, maybe not directly in front of the VCs. I suppose I always had an interest in economics, took economics at university and stuff. But those basic finances are absolutely vital for everyone. Everyone in the business ideally should know at an early stage. Is this going to work? Because it affects everything.
Yeah. No. Look, that's done right. That's really accurate. That's really powerful. That is the stuff that VCs will want to see done at 6, 12, 18, 24 months. If we do seed funding with you now, where can you be in 16, 18 months so that we can go Series A? And it's, you kind of have to really know that well. And a benefit that you have is that you can also link up with your sales guy, who would then actually be really able to talk to you about conversion, likelihood of bringing in revenue on some of these customers, and if he can sales forecast his pipeline, would have you coming across really, really well.
Yeah, it also tells you a lot about the VCs. Like, some VCs we talk to are like, give us 5-year or 7-year projections, and then straight away I'm like, no, I can't. Like, that, like, I can make up numbers, but they're absolutely made up.
Tech,
and that will
tech unicorn, $10 billion valuation.
Yeah, but that would also tell you a lot about what these VCs, you know, are these VCs legitimately an early stage venture? Because any legitimate early stage VC will know anything post 18 months or possibly 24 months is completely made up anyway.
Yeah.
And again, like, is a VC asking you these questions? Will it, again, tell you a lot about how experienced they are, how clued into the ecosystem they are? And good domain-specific VCs will know these for other companies. I would be able to tell you that, you know, what you're predicting is either way off or way too high or way too low. So they'll use this as a sounding board as well for how clued in and how much due diligence you've done as well on the market.
Yeah. It's one in there. And it's something that I hear a lot of founders saying is that, yeah, VCs can't value us correctly, but like, look, you're in the AI NLP space, focusing on mental health. mental health awareness. Like if you go into a company that primarily works with computer vision and autonomous driving companies, going to be a mismatch there. Valuations are going to be off. Probably not going to be happy. Or even just some more standard SaaS companies, right? They just won't give you a fair run for your money.
No, completely. I like when it comes to the one thing VCs absolutely hate is that you go into them and you tell them this is a $10 billion market and we're going to take 1% of it. That's like 101 that this founder does not have a clue what they're talking about. going into those VCs and going, these are the 10 companies who we're piloting with, of which there are 100 in the world, of which we expect to get like 10 more the next year and 10 more the following year. That shows you on the ball. Yeah, shows you haven't just Googled a quick question.
No, it's good insight on that. So if we talk about, look, the technical skills that are there, I'd normally chat, you know, what technical skills are important. But if we say business skills, what business skills have really helped you in the last 18 months? Let's say one that you already had, and then one that you've learned in the last 18 months.
I suppose already I would sort of consider those product, like user interview skills to be sort of business. And that's something I already had, like being able to sit down with a user and not necessarily formally conduct an interview with them, but understand what they need from your product. I think that's really valuable. So I think I already had that and it's improved, but that's been really good. I suppose something I've learned definitely would be the sales. The sales is really quite important. Also, like financial bookkeeping and like financial forecasting, super boring, know way more about like tax law and like POSI and like pay scales than I ever wanted to know or ever needed to know. And I really hate knowing about it, but yeah, like how much is your employee going to cost you over the next 3 years with like tax and pensions and like pay rises and all this kind of absolute BS. But important to know.
Fancy studying that instead of data science.
Yeah, no, interesting to some people, not to me, but something that I get now know more about than I expected to or particularly want to.
Good. What are your three non-negotiables when it comes to leadership or being a co-founder?
Professionalism will be one. As a co-founder, like as an employee, I think you tend to kind of like gossip and chit chat and kind of with your colleagues. I think as a founder, you need to be, as any leader, you need to be kind of one step removed. You need to show a certain level of professionalism and decorum. And even in an early stage startup, I think you need to show that. Trust is absolutely paramount bidirectionally, that I trust you and you trust me, and always starting with kind of a full battery of trust. And then like if things go wrong, that reduces, but not starting the other way around. Sort of a new term that's come on the market recently is called psychological safety. So that's giving your colleagues an environment where they feel safe to, I suppose, to criticize, to be conflicting, to open up about things. And again, from having worked in companies where there probably wasn't that psychological safety, where employees didn't feel that they could raise their hand to go, that's not right. Like that's a bad decision you're making at leadership level. I didn't want to run a company like that, and I don't believe we are running a company like that. It can be hard to hear as a founder when someone raises your hand and goes, that's BS, but I think it builds for a better company long term.
Do you think, God forbid if I'm fair any way I'll say this, do you think Maslow's hierarchy needs is becoming outdated in the modern world?
Oh, that's a very that's a question to have over a couple of pints, I suspect. say it's becoming outdated,
I was going to say the big part that I feel that's coming out is like it's not self-actualization now. People want group actualization more so than self. that's, look, is if it's an extra layer or whatever it might be, I think that makes, just considering, yeah.
That's an interesting point. I'd pivot it slightly and I'd say our group actualization has changed. I think, like, looking back two generations ago, you know, your parents lived in a farming community and everyone was a farmer and everyone was, like, in that community. And now we're trying to get this group actualization from typically from the workplace, which is way harder. Like, if you, again, like, we work in vastly multinational settings. Like, your colleagues are from places you've never even heard of. And if you think of how, compare this to your parents or your grandparents' generation, like, we have it way harder, like to put it bluntly. So yeah, I think people are trying to get that actualization probably from the workplace, and there's a disconnect there where it is harder than they expect. I think that's where a lot of issues stem from. Yeah. That's my, over a couple of pints, random opinion, completely unfounded.
I know, it's just something, it's just stuff I think about. It's the stuff I think about when I'm sitting in bed and I can't sleep. last question, it's no wonder I can't sleep. Last question, Fionn. What is a book, piece of content, or podcast that you recommend for other people, either in a co-founding position or looking to make the jump, that you'd recommend?
Two things. I suppose the book would be Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Don't know if you've read that yourself. It's
that one I have, yeah.
Yeah, Kahneman was a Nobel laureate. Super interesting book. Podcast and blog post. There is I can send it to you. There's a really random, really long blog post about an engineering manager at Google at the time who probably relatively unethically experimented on his team in terms of productivity and what made them better or worse when it came to like velocity, like how much you were putting on top of them. But like quite interestingly shows that how not measuring like how many lines of code people write really does not work. And I think as a founder, you're very tempted to do that. You're very tempted to go, we need to work faster. And yeah, this blog post is a long read. It's a good, like, it's actually a 40-minute podcast, I think, as well. But definitely changed my thinking about how you measure efficiency and velocity on technical teams. Yeah, all sorts of those things. Cannot for the life of me remember it, what it was called. But if you Google, engineering manager, velocity, Google, you'd probably find it.
Well, if you remember it as well, what we'll do is we'll link Thinking Fast and Slow, and we'll link the blog into the post-it notes.
Yep, super.
But Fionn, that takes us up for time. Look, it was great having you. Really enjoyed it. Enjoyed having you on the show, and thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, delighted to be here. Shocked that I'm your first Irish guest. I don't know, is that honored or unfortunate, but I'm glad to be here.
The closest I've got was the guys from the computer vision startup that came out of Trinity, Raphael and Constantinos, from Volagrams. Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, no Irish guests, unfortunately. Until now.
Well, I hope that only improves going forward.
Hopefully. Thanks a million, Fionn.
Thanks, Anthony. Take it easy.
That concludes another enlightening episode of the Leadership Labs podcast. If you found today's episode thought-provoking and informative, be sure to subscribe to the Leadership Labs on your preferred podcast platform or on YouTube. Thank you once again for joining us on this journey through the Leadership Labs. Until next time.